You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hi, and welcome to The Compass, the podcast documenting the struggles of life as an artist. I'm Leah Walsh.
Hi, everyone. My guest today is Georgia Saxelby. Georgia is an installation artist whose work explores the relationship between art, architecture, ritual, and cultural identity. You'll get to hear all about her work in the episode. It's really interesting. She was introduced to me by the amazing Yasmani Arboleda, who was on episode 73. She's originally from Sydney, went through New York, and is currently based in DC. So this was recorded over Skype. You can check out her work at georgiasaxelby.com. Before we get started, I just wanted to give you a little bit of information here at the top about Georgia's latest project, Two Future Women. You'll hear all about the process of that project in the episode, but it's something that you can participate in if you'd like, so I just wanted to give you that information. Two Future Women memorializes the anniversary of the Women's March in Washington, D.C. The project invites you to write a letter to women in 20 years' time. Part art and part history, our collective trove of letters will be archived for 20 years by participating national cultural institutions in Washington, D.C., and re-exhibited in 2037 on the 20th anniversary of the Women's March. You are invited to add your letter to the archive. The project will be open for 6 months until July 2018, and the postal address will be changing monthly. Currently receiving letters at the Phillips Collection, handwrite and mail your letter to the artist at Two Future Women, Georgia Saxelby, care of the Phillips Collection, 1600 21st Street, Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. Okay, so listen to her great story, check out the website, and I hope you participate. I also hope you enjoy the 111th episode of The Compass. And within that, kind of, what is the dark side for you most often? Whatever you think it is.
You know, I guess it's funny because the dark side could mean so many things. On the one hand, the first thing that came to mind is, these periods of self-doubt that artists go through, which I think is a normal part of the creative process. So, you know, sometimes it's nice to welcome those periods as a great way of reshuffling our feathers and refining our kind of critical position within our practice. But, you know, the dark side can also mean, you know, a sense of purpose. And sometimes that's not just inner purpose, but sometimes, you know, it's nice to... Sometimes a sense of purpose as an artist requires platforms of presentation, you know, so when you don't have, exhibitions coming up or, you know, in the case of visual artist or whatever presentation opportunity might be for the different mediums within art, it can sometimes also rob you of your sense of purpose, even though we don't want it to, right? Because we want our art practice to be this kind of deep inner, you know, almost spiritual practice where we would just be kind of chipping away at it in our studio spaces, regardless of, you know, if the outside world cared or not.
Right.
And maybe it's particularly, you know, it's more relevant for me now as a installation artist where I make work that is site responsive. So sometimes the dark side can come when there isn't something on the horizon and... I can lose my way, and that's why, you know, I'm trying to develop almost like, you know, a little bit of a daily practice that is almost completely disconnected from whatever larger installation work or presentation opportunities I'm working on, so that, you know, it serves the place of daily meditation.
Yeah.
And it also keeps my hands working so that, you know, when I'm, you know, when I have to do a lot of admin or a lot of intellectual work or a lot of convincing a lot of people to trust me and all those kind of more like strategic and outwardly focused things, you know, I haven't lost the ability to draw or play with clay, which, you know, sometimes I feel like I lose that in periods and it's really hard to start again. And, you know, I heard this, someone told me this thing about, I think it was David Lynch, has a practice where every day for 2 hours, the same 2 hours, I think it's like 10 a.m. to noon, let's say, he goes to the same diner and drinks the same cup of coffee. He doesn't have a cell phone or doesn't bring it and sits down and has his personal time, I guess, for dreaming or developing or whatever, and emails don't exist, and no matter what is happening, no matter what the stakes are or how intense it is. I mean, this might be a myth, but I've been thinking about that so much lately, like this idea of carving out 2 hours every day, you know, before you kind of get all the things you need done to just go and be your, express kind of your inner artist or express just do your art practice for you and to always keep that. And I think developing that daily kind of ritual, I think that is something that I believe, at least for me, would help me not slip into, you know, periods of the dark side.
Yeah, totally. I need to read about this thing he does.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. There are books about the creative processes of, you know, Simone de Beauvoir had a really beautiful mm-hmm. one where she would kind of break between like 1 and 5 and then go back to the studio. You know, it's like ways of incorporating socializing or the outside world into your daily life in a really regular way.
Yeah, and well, I know you said that a lot of your work has to do with ritual as well. Are you conscious of that when you're kind of building your pattern them as kind of rituals or giving them a higher importance?
Yeah, of course. So, you know, it's funny. I just sat down with one of my mentors last week and kind of had this big self-critique of the fact that, and I've thought this for a while, you know, I'm dealing with these notions of ritual in the content of my work and kind of lamenting that the processes of my art practice don't always add up, because just like everyone else, you know, I get stressed or put all my self-care activities aside, you know, right. when I have a big show or something like that. And me, out of all people, like, you know, who literally researches the benefits of, you know, ritual and daily activities, you know, and how much I, want to allow the processes of my art practice to mirror that. So we were kind of brainstorming some techniques of how to develop that but of course I'm always last minute and you know, doing interactive installations, sometimes, you know, getting permission from the institution or all the rigmarole you have to go through or convincing someone to letting you present something and then having to build something very, very quickly. All the installation work I've done has been built very quickly. And I actually, when I don't have a presentation opportunity in mind, like a site, it's really hard for me to develop work because it just stays in the abstract realm. Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, then when like all those thoughts and those abstractions, you know, when there is nothing coming up, no exhibition coming up, they feed into when I do get an exhibition opportunity. But really, like, I need a site to make my work. And that's really difficult because it means I find it really hard to just chip away at my work in my studio every day. It's really, right. My balance at the moment seems to be these periods of like deep intensity and then deep withdrawal rather than, you know, a weekly kind of balance of both.
Yeah. Yeah. That has to be frustrating sometimes, but exciting when you get the chance to crystallize everything all of a sudden.
Yeah, when I'm kind of, it's almost like I'm forced to bring down all my kind of abstract ideas that I've been mulling over in a really kind of poetic way. But, you know, I want to, for example, like, yeah, I want to create this kind of temple, but I don't know what it looks like, or I only know kind of like what it might feel like or something. And then, you know, when I get an exhibition opportunity, then I have to find out, you know, what material am I going to build it out of? How big is it going to be? And I really have to make some of those practical decisions which turn it into a thing in the real world. But until I'm forced to do that, I think it, just like an architect, like a site is incredibly important, and especially because I'm not dedicated to a medium. So I'm not, you know, a clay artist or a timber artist or a steel artist, or, right. You know, I'm kind of, I guess my medium, if I had to choose, is the symbolic interactions between people, and then how space and objects can generate symbolic interactions. So you're right. It is frustrating and exhilarating, and then deeply exhausting all the same time.
Can you tell us, just so the listeners know a little bit about how you've developed this process or the kind of work that you do now? Do you come from an architecture background, or how did you get into art?
It's a really big question.
I know it is.
So I trained as a painter for 5 years.
Okay.
And I was a very kind of expressive painter in the end, and worked very hard to become, you know, very good at that. And I think I had a love of colour and a love of not necessarily the medium of paint, because I used to find it annoying doing, you know, exercises to get better at painting, but I wanted so badly to be able to express myself, so I wanted to get good, but I wasn't necessarily in love with the chemicals or the, you know, the material of paint in the same way that others were, or I hadn't necessarily been drawing and sketching since I was 2 years old like some of the other art students. I had thoughts about the world, and I wanted to develop a voice. And I'm a very deeply visual person, and so I was always also a symbolic artist, so the symbolic always, you know, mattered to me. I found it really hard to just kind of paint still lives, or not that there's anything wrong with that, but for me, kind of analogies and what things represented, and, you know, and I became also fascinated with masks for a long time, and that was kind of my first like painterly kind of object making thing outside of kind of canvas and paint. And in my final year, I wrote my thesis on ritual. I wanted to choose an area of humanity that was kind of enabled me to express a sense of our shared human existence, which could be anything, right? We all need shelter, we all need food, there's so many things that kind of talk about our commonalities and our humanness. But for some reason I chose ritual, and I probably because it's deeply symbolic. It shares the same language of art in that way. Both are symbolic languages. One thing means something else. It's how we express our understanding of the universe through these kind of symbolic gestures that we develop and pass on. And, you know, they change between cultures, but there's many things that are the same in between. Mm-hmm. And I just never stopped thinking and talking about it. And I used to try and make paintings about it, even though it's like inherently performative and spatial. But I, you know, when you're producing a body of work as a final year student, I didn't know how to start kind of performing and, you know, in conjunction with my paintings. And I wasn't ready to give up painting yet. I was so dedicated to it, you know, it was really hard. And then as soon as I graduated, you know, I just needed to, I had a big show coming up with a whole bunch of other, you know, graduate students in a big old shipping warehouse on Sydney's harbour. Mm. So I had this big space, there's no white walls. So I couldn't, paintings weren't really appropriate for that space. And I decided I wanted to create this like birthday ritual to use all the tropes of a birthday setting, but as kind of this like ancient, you know, to really amplify its symbolic nature. And I'd been camping for the last 2 months, been in lots of bonfires, and I used the bonfire format and kind of, it was just, it was a weird thing. I collaborated with a very famous patissiere in Australia who made me this gigantic cake, which I painted on.
Oh my goodness.
But with icing. And I had this kind of circle of beautifully painted birthday hats, all expressively hand painted, that were kind of hanging above head height when sitting. And I just made this kind of this arena, and then there was no instructions, and I just left it, and it took about an hour for someone to eventually sit down, and then they all started, you know, they all started lighting the candles that I'd left there, and then as soon as the candles were lit, they in kind of instantly went into singing each other happy birthday, and then you know they decided someone needed to blow out the candles. And they couldn't decide, so they all did it together and made a wish, and then they kind of, everyone was cheering and they handed out, this cake was just eaten over hours at this kind of opening night, and it was the first time where my kind of ideas about ritual and how rituals are inherently connective and we do them, they're like deeply ingrained within us, you know, people didn't just get it, they felt it, they were literally embodying it, and I realized that I'd made 200 people in a gallery in this opening night sing each other happy birthday and then laugh and share food for the rest of the night just through creating a space. And so I started to understand the importance of space and how it can be used to generate very special moments between people, and how it can be used in relation to the platform of art to allow us to kind of, you know, understand our ritual behaviors and I started researching architecture ever since, and how you create space and how you facilitate the kind of interactions I want us to have more, really special moments of community and gathering and
yeah, because the spaces we live in really influence everything about our lives.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. That was a long story. I hope it.
No, that was perfect.
I wanted to give you a specific example.
No, it totally illustrated what you're trying to do. Thank you.
Yeah. So I've been working with architects ever since. And a lot of my research has been architectural, and I had this desire. I wanted to start making kind of installations that were temple-like, or, you know, if I want to create special moments between people, I also want to create special spaces, you know. And you're right. I think there's a famous quote that I don't remember who it's attributed to, but we shape our environment and then it shapes us. And you know, I just started noticing, like, and you know, everything that the urban environment, how it looks and feels, you know, how our homes look and feel, and then our special spaces, whether they're monuments and memorials and, you know, looking up and they're all white men on horses in bronze, you know, and, you know, they're not necessarily, they don't represent me, and they don't represent the kind of value systems like that I'm trying to, you know, that I'm thinking about and working towards within my own life, or that I wish our society had. And so I guess my art became this kind of desire, and I'm still, you know, working on it and building the skills, but, you know, ultimately I hope I can create spaces, you know, calling them artworks, you know, using the platform of public art or, you know, installation art, but really creating special spaces that either are, you know, gathering points or ceremonial, or, you know, they represent a kind of more inclusive or progressive value system. So I'm kind of, you know, deeply researching how different human cultures have made sacred space in the past, and it goes hand in hand with the rituals they facilitate. So, you know, what can I learn, you know, not just from Western culture and Western architecture, but from all sorts of architectures, because, you know, some cultures, you know, like where I'm from, you know, Aboriginal Australians, they don't necessarily create permanent architectures. Maybe we don't need permanence. They don't need to be in bronze and marble. Maybe they're ephemeral. Maybe they're cyclical. You know, maybe they activate at a certain time of year.
Well, something I usually ask people about, because I'm really curious about how geography influences people as artists. How have you found that your process has changed going from Australia to New York and now I find it fascinating that you're in DC where you're surrounded by these monuments and you're also in the capital of the United States. It must be an interesting time to be looking at social interactions in this country, in DC.
You are incredibly right, and that is why I decided to spend a chunk of time in DC. As an Australian, you know, I mean, that's an interesting for me to just reflect on right now, and I'm sure I'll have more thoughts on this as it evolves, but as an Australian, we have different conceptions of space and landscape than, you know, as any culture does, but you really feel it when you're Australian. You know, we live on an island and, you know, 80% of the population lives on the East Coast. You know, so this whole continent and, you know, mainly the population just lives on this East Coast. And there's a sense of boundlessness or kind of just ongoing plains, just so much kind of land. And a lot of that is bush, not forest, not mountains, like bush. Like the Australian bush is very specific, and it has certain smells and, you know, the gum trees. And when you go out a little bit, you know, the earth is red. So you've got that whole kind of desert thing that is in our psyche, even though most people live in cities, you know, of course. The Australian art legacy is one of landscape painting. Hmm. So landscape painting has kind of defined generations of artists and, you know, because I guess Australians realised their uniqueness from their English, I'm talking about white Australians, obviously, from their English predecessors by embracing the landscape, which was so different. And then, of course, you have these, you know, for me, this complexity, and, you know, for me, like, also I have to admit, like, a lot of shame that comes with being a white Australian in a culture that I don't feel, you know, has this horrible history and kind of contemporary, you know, contemporary activities of, you know, oppressing its Indigenous population. And so a lot of artists and designers and architects, like, think about that and think about, you know, the Indigenous culture and the Indigenous population and in a practical way, whether it is housing and health issues or, you know, for me, in a cultural way, like art and ritual, no one does it better than Australian, you know, Aboriginals, the oldest living culture. Art and ritual are the exact same thing. Mm. And so this kind of deep respect and awe for this culture, you know, and this desire to create a new kind of Australian paradigm that identifies way more with it, with the Indigenous culture is something that has really shaped a lot of my formative thinking. And then bringing it to New York, I mean, I actually had a really hard time choosing. I was either going to move to New York, which had been a dream of mine for a long time, or do a kind of 1 or 2 year ritual and sacred space pilgrimage around the world, like backpacking. Uh-huh. And it was just so hard kind of choosing, as if I was choosing two different sides of myself or whatever. And obviously there's not so much ritual and sacred space in New York, but I wanted the kind of the exposure to, you know, the sense of almost like liberation and access to cultural institutions and to cultural legacies that New York has, you know, as a city. And so I had this certain amount of time I could go on this visa. And so I went, you know, but yeah, there was, when I was there, you know, I loved it and I can't wait to go back, but there was always a sense that I wanted to expose myself to, you know, to just, I'm just so intrigued right now by what young artists or any artists are creating in Mexico City and Senegal and, you know, Sarajevo and Montreal, you know. So as soon as I got there, I realized that this whole time I've been orientating to this kind of inverted commas center of the art world, and really what was happening on the periphery is actually so much more interesting to me now. And then, you know, to wind up, I guess, DC has, yeah, it's been transformative for my art practice, because you're right, there are so many, I mean, the National Mall is just like,
yeah, there's nothing else like it.
Yeah, and the the Washington Monument is just so phallic. And you look at it and you cannot deny it, and it just is like this beacon of the way that, like, national identity in Western culture is kind of intricately entwined with masculinity and, like, kind of this phallocentric, you know, worldview. And the monuments reflect that. And I just dream about, like, what feminine monuments would be, just as an antidote, you know, to everything I see around me. And I guess since being here, I've been using things like performance in relation to the monuments, or you know, kind of alternative ways of historicizing events that have happened at the monuments, like the Women's March, and so using this kind of rigid permanent architectural shapes in relation to performative gestures, and has been kind of my way of tackling it, which is interesting because you don't think sacred space. Yes, I want to create my own monuments, my own temples, but also kind of supplementing what's already there in a disruptive way is kind of what's naturally come out of me while I've been here.
Yeah, because those things are so huge and they're so immovable. I saw a few pictures on your website of, was it at the Lincoln Memorial that you had those performers all in, like, red, orange outfits?
Yeah. So that was
beautiful.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, so that's a video work that I did when I first arrived, and I brought two amazing performance artists, Viva Sudan and Bailey Nolan, down from New York to work with me. And, you know, my question was, if our rituals reflect and define our ethos and our value systems, can you reverse engineer that? So can you invent rituals for a culture that doesn't yet exist? And what would rituals of a culture that, where our cultural relationship to women, you know, and non-binary gender identities was, like, thriving? Like, let's just picture that culture. Let's try and dream up the rituals that that culture would have.
Please.
And perform them to try and, like, literally embody that or feel what it feels like to kind of perform those rituals. And then, it kind of, just being here in DC, it seemed important. We actually performed them at, like, maybe five different monuments around DC. We filmed them in, you know, this kind of guerrilla way, and we wanted to use the way that we found to see ourselves in the monuments was to kind of break apart the symbolic, you know, meanings and associations and signifiers, and just use them as physical forms. And so we started to find our bodies within them, like the fluting of the columns of the Lincoln Memorial fits my body perfectly, you know, and so I can kind of fold into it, or the steps is the exact length between my, you know, my foot and my hip, and so I can fold myself over it and, you know, feel the cold stone against, you know, my warm hands, and so really kind of being there with those forms and almost like using their physicality to, like, reclaim them as our own was kind of how we went about it, which was an interesting process in the end.
Yeah, I love that. How does your family feel about you choosing to be an artist for your career?
I think they're very proud of me now, but I chose to become an artist about 9 years ago. I was enrolled in an economics law degree.
Oh.
And I had the good sense to defer for a year and travel. I traveled, I backpacked around the world for a year after high school, which is not atypical of an Australian, but I formed my own value systems in that time and was able to kind of reconfigure what success meant for me as a kind of 18 and 19 year old. And 2 weeks before I came back, I changed to fine arts, and I Skyped them. I was in Japan at the time, and I'd been reading about this psychological technique where if you want to tell someone really bad news, you tell them something much worse first. It's So I told them I was pregnant. And then I told them, no, I'm joking. But I did drop out of law school. And they were just, yeah, they were kind of really shocked because I hadn't really been filling them in on everything that had been changing in my mindset, because I knew I'd be too easily convinced out of it during the process of it. And so they kind of probably thought I was ruining my life. I think they were very confused, as you can imagine, you know, law to fine art. They supported me, and they kept asking for a very long time how I was going to make money and when I would get a proper job. But you know, which is, I think, more understandable in hindsight. Whereas when I was a student, I was like, I don't know, I'll figure it out. You know,
right.
I didn't like those questions then.
Right.
And I think when I did for 8 months have a proper job at an architecture firm in New York, because I wanted to get experience, you know, working with architects. So it was still always to take it back to my own practice. But I think my dad was very excited, and he was very confused why I wanted to quit. And I had to tell him, you know, I'm dreaming about making art every single day. Like, I can't do this, you know, even though it was an amazing job at an amazing firm. Like, and I think when he heard how unhappy I was, he understood. And sometimes they surprise me with their support, you know. Like, I think the other month I was having a chat with my dad, trying to figure out, you know, if I'd go on an artist visa, or if I'd, you know, do graduate studies, and what I would need to do if I wanted to stay in the US and this kind of thing. And my brother's a businessman as well, so it's a funny contrast. But,
right.
You know, and I just felt the need, you know, in a really soft way. I said, oh, I'm so, so sorry, Dad. Like, I, you know, could have been a lawyer. We wouldn't have had to deal with any of this kind of stuff. And, you know, this is really hard. I'm going to, you know, it's going to be really hard figuring out how to support myself. And he just told me not to apologize, and how proud he was of me, and how this is what why he worked so that I could make the choice to become an artist. And so sometimes they do really beautiful things when I realize that they get it. And other times, you know, I think I've just become incredibly comfortable with, you know, disappointing others in order to stay true to myself, and taking risks. I'm really good at just taking risks and kind of following the beat of my own heart.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Maybe it is because I had a family that was so different, you know. So sometimes I wish I was from a super bohemian, like an amazing artistic family.
Right.
But the fact that, you know, I'm a little bit different from them means that I've so thoroughly made my own choices my whole life. And I think I'm really grateful for that. And I'm so grateful that they, you know, are the kind of people that, regardless of if I'm doing something a bit like wacky to them, they still back it.
Yeah, they still come along with you. Well, yeah. I was going to ask, yeah, if your ability to take risks was something that you've always done, or if you feel like you've found ways to get even better at it as you've grown.
I think that's a really good question. I think that looking back at, you know, high school, I remember deeply wanting and actively seeking to do exchange in a foreign country, mm-hmm. as kind of like a 15-year-old. And so I studied French like adamantly my whole high school career, which is not that common in Australia because we're so far away from, you know, Europe. So it's not necessarily common to speak a second language. And so there was this sense that even, you know, as this kind of tiny high schooler, this, you know, even 12, 13 years old, that, you know, I think you don't do that. You don't dedicatedly, you know, study another language without this desire, like this kind of feeling that you're going to be living in other countries. And so I think I always wanted an adventurous life. And I actually think, you know, my formation as an artist has 100% been hand in hand with my formation as a traveler.
Mm.
or maybe they both stem from this idea of like living kind of an adventurous and extraordinary life, and which you can do in obviously like many different ways. Right. And it's hard, and I'm realizing that now. You know, you have to leave people behind. You know, if you want to live in different kinds of cultures like I do, you have to be restarting things, and it's not strategic for your career and all this kind of stuff. But you, you know, but yeah, so kind of hearing that voice, so yeah. And also, I mean, backpacking, you know, at 18, and then at 21 I took myself to India by myself for 3 months.
Oh, amazing.
To travel, you know, and because, you know, this kind of artistic sense of like the color and just exposure to different kind of cultural frameworks other than what I'd been exposed to, you know. And then in terms of getting better at it, I think I probably developed a muscle memory of doing making decisions that weren't strategic, or, you know, were very risky or had no kind of bottom line benefit except for a sense of curiosity about the world or the thrill or the, you know, and making them anyway, and it so thoroughly being the right thing or leading to these like unexpected paths that I could never have imagined. And so that kind of, I guess, developed a value system of really believing in the, like, you know, like the magic of life. You know?
Yeah.
And I sometimes I think that's what my art is actually about, this kind of, you know, trying to express the joy and the magic of life and the world, you know. Therefore, it is a deeply spiritual practice, and therefore traveling, I think, is like an inherent and this like getting to know the world and everything the world has to offer is, you know, really an inherent part of why I'm an artist.
Making me want to go on a trip somewhere right now.
Me too.
Can we talk a little bit about the project that you're just coming off of?
Mm-hmm.
That I know had to do with the Women's March, and yeah, I'm really excited to hear about it.
Sure. What do you want to know?
Well, I guess what gave you the idea, and like, do you think of yourself as an activist? I guess that's part of the question too.
It's a great question.
Or yeah, what kind of change you're looking to spark with this kind of project, especially since it's just in conversation with so many events, like the political conversation right now and the world conversation.
Totally.
A lot of things. I'm sorry.
Sorry.
A lot of things all at once.
No, that's what I love. I've just launched a project which is now ongoing called To Future Women, which you can find out all about at tofuturewomen.com. And basically it's an interactive artwork which is both digital and physical, that launched on the 21st of January, 2018, this year, to mark the one-year anniversary of the Women's March in DC. So it launched at the Phillips Collection, a national museum here, and it asks participants both at the museum and all over the world to write and mail in a letter to women in 20 years' time. And then I will archive these letters here in DC at participating institutions. So, for example, the Phillips Collection is archiving their portion for 20 years and re-exhibit them on January 21st in 2037 to mark the 20th anniversary of the Women's March. So the project has a few different factors, you know, the purpose or the, you know, why I felt drawn to making it. The first is to kind of reinterpret and, you know, in the platform of art in a, you know, poetic and formal way, what's already happening with the Women's March and with Me Too, where we're kind of, you know, individually contributing symbolic gestures that accumulate into a larger collective gesture, like the Me Too hashtag basically became a symbolic gesture, or like everybody coming to Washington DC, or, you know, in all the different places all over the world where the Women's March kind of spread to, and being there and showing our body or self-expressing. So this act of self-expression amongst people about women's issues and women's experiences. And so, you know, providing another platform in a more formal setting to self-express and to shift the focus of the conversation into where we want to go as a culture, not just where we are, but to really think about the woman who's going to be reading that letter in 2037 and to really think about the world that we want her to be living the and to kind of also talk to her about our experiences now. And so the other part of the artwork is kind of disrupting institutional processes of historicization. Mm-hmm. So kind of infiltrating the archives of these museums as a way of alternatively historicizing what was the largest single protest in American history, potentially global history, right. You know, knowing that history has a tendency of forgetting the contributions of women or, you know,
glossing over it.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, for example, right now I know that the centenary of the suffragette movement's about to come up next year, and I am actively filling gaps and holes in my knowledge of that history. I don't know it as well as I know other historical movements, and, you know, just as well, I mean, Me Too, that was a digital movement that, you know, might seem small or like a trend, but it has meant that companies have fired directors and museums have cancelled shows of famous male artists, and it has had very real world repercussions, and it has smashed a long held taboo which has crippled women and all sorts of people from speaking out about harassments which really enforce oppression. You know, so it's no small feat. And so, you know, like finding a way, using the platform of art to mark and memorialize a event that happened outside of the walls of that cultural institution, you know, and reactivating those institutions, because museums were used and visited on the day of the Women's March here, you know, whether it was for bathrooms or safe spaces, or, you know, they archived ephemera and protest signs afterwards. And so they played a really active role in a way I've never seen museums play before. And so kind of inviting them to be part of that conversation in DC, and then, you know, inviting participants from across geographies to participate in this archive and contribute their voice to this archive, no matter what language they speak or what perspective they come from, knowing that they can post me a letter and that I will read it and I will archive it for them in DC, where the march happened. You know, so that gives a bit of background to the project, which will be open for 6 months, and anyone can, you know, post me a letter. The address will change.
Well, yeah, we can definitely link to that information. I'm sure a lot of people will want to write in.
Yeah, amazing. I would love them to. There's prompts, there's questions on the website to kind of help, you know, write such a big, bold letter, you know, to the next generation of women, you know, and what we hope for them, what changes we want for them, right. What stories we want to pass on to them.
Well, it's scary to watch in real time with the news cycle changes so quickly, and the things that different outlets choose to highlight. The headline that they use about something completely changes what people might think it's about. So yeah, totally. I think that's so important what you're saying, like to have documentation.
Yeah, of and people's the letter, experiences. The, you know, as a format has traditionally been used to, you know, reveal intimate histories. And so I wanted, you know, to give us a chance of creating our own history by telling our own stories and as personal as we want, you know. I was reading this letter last week that this kind of 66-year-old man wrote, you know, and he chose to write it to his mum, who he lost about 16 years ago, and all about how he realizes that she raised him, because like the details of the kind of person she raised him to be, and, you know, finishing with in 2037, I hope that the world is full of more women like you. And, you know, like, that is such a personal way of, you know, comprehending this man's relationship to this woman in his life. You know, like, what a, I mean, news and essays and policy change, all of that is vital. But I think so too is you know, the poetic and the symbolic and the reflection and contemplation and the heartfelt. You know, it's kind of like a performative memorial, in a way, to not just what happened, but also to who we want to become.
Yeah.
And knowing that it's going in this time capsule and that we won't have access to it for two decades, for one generation of women, and then there's going to be people on the other side of that reading it, hopefully touched that we were thinking of them, you know.
Yeah. What has it been like for you to be opening these letters and reading them just personally?
It's almost incomprehensible. I just deinstalled two days ago all the letters, you know, the hundreds of letters that were written at the Phillips, you know, that kind of were taped on their wall like this like a shrine, really. And I have this big bundle of letters that have been posted in, you know, obviously I go every 2 days and pick up more and more and more that are arriving from overseas or whatnot. And now I get the privilege and the honor of sitting down, you know, over the next week and couple of weeks and reading every single one and digitizing them, because they'll be made digitally available for the next 6 months. And, you know, I feel completely, I don't feel like I'm the artist of the project. I feel like I birthed something which is now completely separate from me, and people are taking ownership of it, and people are using their own language to describe it, and it's just the heartfelt nature of what people are expressing and the level of integrity just kind of shows how much we need this. Like we ought not to devalue the act of self-expression. You know, just the act of self-expressing is so, you know, cathartic and healing and hopeful. And so I just feel nothing but, you know, honored that I might, you know, play a role in providing a platform of self-expression for others who are feeling the same way as me, you know?
Right.
And you asked before also, if I considered myself an activist, I didn't uh-huh. answer. I think I consider myself an artist, and, you know, deeply interested and respectful of the work that activists do, and, you know, certainly as someone who, you know, marched themselves and will march again, and, you know, is interested in, you know, I'm now interested in like all collecting and understanding all sorts of different collective acts of protest and dissent and revolution that groups of women have engaged in throughout different histories to try and understand how they have co-opted and appropriated public space, what kind of symbolic gestures they're doing, and what that reveals about space and humanity and women's ability to network with each other in order to, you know, have their voices heard. Mm-hmm. So I'm really interested in learning more about that, which obviously, you know, they are moments of activism. But I deeply feel, you know, like an artist, almost as if art is my religion, you know, like, and the desire to contribute to cultural change is just a natural part of that.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, but I think that's beautiful that you want your artwork to be in conversation with those big movements and with those big moments.
Oh, well, I learned so much from them. You know, like I was reading about the mothers from the Argentinian dictatorship, you know, a few decades ago, and what they would do, these like really poetic symbolic actions that they would do in public space to protest the disappearing of their children by the government. Or, you know, right now I was reading in Iran that, you know, the women some women are protesting compulsory wearing of hijabs, and like the symbolic gestures that they're doing to protest, like, I just, it's so expressive and so poetic, and it's so intuitive, and I just learned so much from them, you know?
Yeah. Is there any, speaking of learning, are there any like lessons that you've learned over the last couple of years that you're really proud of that you want to tell me about? Could be like a small thing. It could be something about the way you make your work or the way you live, whatever you think.
That I'm proud of.
Yeah.
Let me just think for 1 second.
Sure.
I think that's a really beautiful question, Leah.
Yeah.
I guess in a practical sense, I've learnt, and I'm continuously learning this, but I've learnt to conduct myself as an artist with professionalism, and dealing with, working well with, museums or galleries, compromising, not always, because sometimes, you really need to be the advocate for the integrity of the concept of your work, but really trying to work with them and just really respecting, I deeply respect the role of, curators and arts administrators who love art just as much as me, but have complementary skills or are coming at it from a different perspective. And so I'd say that I'm proud of working with an institution in a respectable professional way. And then in a more poetic sense, I mean, I'm not so much proud of this, but a few things I have learned making interactive installations is that the audience will always surprise you.
Uh-huh.
In a really beautiful way. So, I have to be good enough at what I do to create a space or create an experience which is, facilitates the kind of engagement that I want. So if I want a deeply meaningful engagement, then things like pace and things like, symbolic significance of the materials or, the setting and the way that people walk through the space, all those things, I have to be good at what I do to kind of so that the audience engage with it the way that I'm hoping for, but they still always they put their own twist on it, or they're imaginative, or they understand the ethos of the work and then they add to it. And that has just, I love that. I love when they kind of just take it and make it their own. And another thing is that the gallery minders or the museum, in a museum, the people who protect and look after the work, they're often, I have a lot of like respect for what they do because they're often my link between myself and the participant or myself and the museum, because they stand there and they watch the participants engaging for hours. And yeah. So I've working with the Phillips Collection, I had about 10 of their gallery minders come up to me at different moments in that month and talk to me about what they had noticed about my work and like things that they had seen.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And it was just, it was so beautiful. And so really having, a building a relationship with the different people involved in creating an artwork, whether it's a grant administrator who's receiving your grant, just everyone in the arts ecology. And it's a hard ecology, right? I know it's hard for artists to thrive, but there are so many people involved in helping artists make their kind of dreams come true because they understand the value of it. And having really like personal interactions with them has been a really satisfying part of my practice.
That's wonderful. Yeah, really having respect for how they contribute to what you guys all are all making.
Yeah, and that they get it, and they're with you. It's fantastic. Just, yeah.
Well, there's just two quick questions that I usually end with, so we'll just do those and then I would let you go.
Tell me.
Well, one is when you are feeling like you're in that dark place or kind of an uninspired or unmotivated place, are there any concrete things that you reach for again and again, like a book you reread or a place you go or something like that?
Yeah, that's a great one. I read Women Who Run With the Wolves.
Yes, I've had several people recommend that one.
Yeah, and not cover to cover. I literally, you know, as if it's like a Bible, like pick it up and open any page and gain a sense of kind of like deep primal sense of myself. And I guess because I don't really relate to my own ancestry being, you know, originally English or, you know, very white, I, you know, the relationship this book provides with the ancestry of being a woman. And I know it's problematic, you know, or I don't know how, you know, transgender or non-binary gender people relate to that if they feel welcome to claim that as their own. But for me, it's given me kind of a sense of a past in this like sense of womanness and a kind of mythology related to that past that feels kind of familiar within me, but which I've never been, you know, I can't see representations of that around me, which is a big part of in my art, what I'm trying to create. So that's big. I go on strolls.
Yes. I mean, that's the best.
So that's a huge part of my practice. You know, I walk, you know, not big, long walks, but just, I just ponder and I potter and potter around, you know, the streets and I observe and I, you know, when I'm really kind of connected to like my inner artist self, when I haven't necessarily been like engaging in like business meetings and emails like all the time, then, you know, I'm more sensitive to the world. So the way the light is hitting, you know, a curb, you know, becomes beautiful to me. And so keeping myself sensitive and perceptive by noticing the outside world. And I mean, obviously a lot of it's nature, like the way a certain color, you know, the way the light is shining through a certain color of a petal, you know, becomes like awe inspiring to me. And the rhythm of walking and the fact that it calms you down. And and I try and take my shoes off and I'm barefoot. And then in a larger sense, I have a really great relationship to festivals, like folk festivals. A lot of my friends and I, you know, go to in Australia, or, you know, I've been to Burning Man and all that as well. But like, you know, a few times in my year, going for a week to a, you know, a folk festival in the bush or something, where every day, you know, you're walking around like half clothed and barefoot and experiencing the stars and the moon. That's another thing. I'll end the question on that. I have a really deep relationship with the moon where, you know, wherever I am, whether I'm in Australia or New York, I look up and it's the same moon. It's waxing, waning the same, you know, unlike the seasons and unlike the, you know, the time, the day and the night. And it's kind of like a beacon. And when I was in New York and there's no nature around me, I could always look up and still experience a sense of the universe, separate to the, you know, urban environments we create for ourselves. And so, you know, ideally I like to know when it's waxing and waning and what phase it's in. And that's an indicator of me being grounded, is knowing. And then I used to have a practice, which I'll get back to, where on the new moon, you set yourself an intention for the month. And on the full moon, you revisit that intention. And so, you know, scheduling or structuring your life in this kind of monthly way, which is way more appropriate than a week.
Yeah. And in relation to nature in a way that,
And that's how, exactly. And that's how a lot of old human societies were structured. And, you know, it's shorter than like a semester, but, you know, and a season, but, you know, longer than a week. And so it's a really great time period to have an intention or get a goal done.
I love that. And then the final question is if you've seen anything recently of any art form that you want to recommend. And I know you've been so busy, maybe you haven't had a chance to take in anything else.
Can it be anything like a book, or does it have to be kind of a...
Yeah, it could be...
Exhibition.
It could be either a book, a TV show, a visual art you've seen, whatever you like. Friends stuff.
Well, shout out to my friend Yasmani. His art is amazing, if no one knows him. You should check it out, and Leah will provide you a link.
Yes, and he's been on an episode. I'll have to find the number, but I'll let you guys all know.
Yeah, of course. So my artist peers, conversations I have with them are always inspiring. But at the moment, I'm reading this book called Gender, Space, and Architecture. And... you know, it's like a reader, like, you know, it has little essays and, you know, writings from this kind of vast array of people dealing with the topic over the last few decades. And I'm just like in awe. It's my Bible. And another really great book, if you guys don't know it, is The Book of Symbols.
Oh, I don't know that.
And it says Reflections on Archetypal Images, but basically it's a book of, you know, every kind of symbol from leopard to cloud to, you know, a doorway, you know, to a throne and a bridge.
Yeah, kind of reminds me almost of a dream dictionary.
Yeah, kind of. But the good thing about this is it's not necessarily, it provides a little snapshot of how that symbol, let's just say, you know, the cloud, how different cultures have dealt with the symbol of the cloud in literature and art cool. throughout all of time. So it's a really nice, like, non-Western centered approach to kind of like visual culture, but in a really deep symbolic way. And so it's like certainly my go-to as a kind of ritual artist. So I highly recommend that. And then in terms of shows, let me just, I guess, you know, I was just in Chicago on the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And
oh, that's right, because I'm going tomorrow.
Yeah. And, I was in the Art Institute of Chicago, which is a fantastic museum. And mm-hmm. I really, you know, as I always do, I find myself drawn to the Middle Eastern tapestries and the, you know, African, you know, totemic sculptures and those artifacts and those artworks that just have such a sense of deep kind of spiritual and universal meaning that people use and used, you know, in a way that really expressed their own relationship to kind of the universe or these wider meanings. And, you know, so artworks that that touch upon that kind of deeper sense of what it is to be human are always what, you know, my go-to. So I guess, you know, my recommendation would be to not just stick to the contemporary and the modern sections as we get taught in, you know, in art schools, but to look at, you know, whatever your art form is in a more ancient sense of it.
Yeah, that's a great recommendation. Georgia, thank you so much. This was amazing.
Yeah, I hope...
Such a pleasure.
I hope I've provided some value or benefit, and thank you so much for asking such beautiful questions.
Thank you for listening to the Compass Podcast. If you find these conversations valuable to your life as an artist and would like to support the ongoing production of The Compass, please consider becoming a patron at patreon.com/thecompasspodcast. Pledges start at as little as $1 a month. You'll get access to bonus content, and anything you can give would be greatly appreciated. Also, if you have a moment, please rate or review in iTunes. Every little bit helps other listeners to find the podcast. I'd like to thank the following people for their generosity. The Compass cover art is by Kim Miller, music by Brendan Spieth, audio assistance from Nick Choksi, and a special thanks to Frankie J. Alvarez. See you next time.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.